Lovely, thank you, Catherine. It's quite a mouthful, the title, isn't it? Yeah. I'm Chris Pell from the Ashmolean Museum. I work in the digital collections department, a team, which there's three of us. We're basically charged with improving the quality and quantity of the data in our collections management system. The data in that system then will go on to live again as linked data at some point in the future. But today I'm not talking about the objects, I'm talking about the paper archives that we have. And I don't know where all of you come from, but if you're from similar institutions, you'll have your own sort of stacks of archive paper that you've collected over the years, or centuries in our case. So here's just three of the many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of archive collections that we have. These great people would be horrified at their two or three sentence biographies, I'm sure. If we just look at these in turn, you know, John Evans, archaeologist, numismatist, you've probably heard all of these people if you're any kind of, if you work in museums or archaeology. The John Evans archive is a 5 meter high stack of paper, all handwritten. My colleague Alison, who works on transcribing this archive, she manages to transcribe about 3.5 centimeters of paper per year. And by taking off socks and shoes and doing the calculations, he's worked out that it's going to take her 150 years to get through all of the John Evans archive. Then there's the Arthur Evans archive, who's John Evans' lad. His stack of paper is 10 metres high. So I'm sure you can work out that's 300 years' work. Edward Leeds, he was a keeper at the Ashmolean. Another 5 meter high stack of paper, that's another 150 years work. Poor Alison is going to be working on these archives for just these three for the next 600 years. So it's a great pension that she's going to end up with, but it's an awful long time. And the problem with this is that people perhaps like yourselves, or people that you work with or for, are interested in the content of these archives, you know, what's inside them, for research purposes, the history of science. People are very interested in the archives because you can look back at the thinking that went on behind the development of a science. So John Evans is very interesting if you're interested in the development of paleontology, because his archives have his sort of daily life, and mixed in with that are his thoughts about the axes and stuff that he's found, and his correspondence with other people. And you can sort of trace the development of the of paleontology through these archives. Similarly so with these and all the other hundreds of archives that we have in the museum. So I've been thinking of ways to improve that, to try and get the information out of these archives a bit more quickly. So in my bathtub thinking, I've come up with this sort of intelligent digital assistant that uses machine vision, and rather than transcribing the text in a sort of OCR manner, the idea is that we just treat words as shapes, and you can then look for similar shapes. It's a bit like a robot or something that you might see on the TV that they develop here at Oxford, that they're driving it around the park and it's sort of mapping as it goes and looking at features and trying to work out where it is. So the terrain could be the collection of documents, and the features that it's navigating and trying to identify are these shapes, which just happen to be words rather than lampposts and, you know, buildings and that kind of thing. So there are three basic features of this this tool. One is retrieval. So if you're interested in researching a particular topic, there'll be some words associated with that topic. If you can find some examples of those words in this person's archive, here are axes, for example. There's lots of axes in here. If your archive is, I know that's a paper archive, but we're actually talking about the sort of the digital scans of the paper. The machine would then look for other examples of that shape in the text and return to you the pages that contain that shape or shapes that are similar to that. So the researcher can sort of home in on the pages that are possibly more relevant to their line of research, rather than having to redo the whole lot and sort of happen across interesting things. Another one is sort of, I don't know what to call it, so I've called it auto-transcription. If the machine finds similar shapes for you, builds a sort of dictionary of shapes that it finds in the archive, and you see these and you say, well, all those are this word, axes, so it can then put those words back in, and all of those instances have been transcribed in the document. You haven't got to do it word by word. So by going through, say, a text like this and building a dictionary of all the shapes, you only have to transcribe each word once, and then it will give you a rough draft of the complete document. So hopefully much quicker than doing it by hand and eye. And the last thing, you've perhaps played with this sort of thing before, it's if you're manually transcribing a document, and you often come across words that you just can't read. But if the machine finds you words of the same or similar shape and presents them in with a chunk of the sentence, so these are just lines taken from different documents. This word, so I point that, is the shape that we're interested in here, is the thing that you can't read. Okay, this one doesn't work well because it is actually the wrong word, but it's just to demonstrate the concept that each of these words are in context of a sentence. So the word that you can't read, if that's presented in a context as well, all of this might somehow get your brain thinking along the right lines, and the light will go on, and you'll perhaps have an inkling of what this mysterious word might be. Alison has a number of words in her John Evans archive transcriptions that she can't read, and they're squiggles. So we're going to try something like this. None of this is actually built, of course. I haven't got I can't suddenly bring the application up. The what I'm talking about today is a very, very early sort of trial of the technology, and basically I'm going to be looking at one particular way of describing the shapes of the words. Do people here do I don't know how much to linger on this sort of this kind of work, or shape pulling words and page segmentation out of scans. I just thought I'd show you anyway the rough, a very quick way of segmenting the pages. All I do basically I'm very fortunate because John Evans writes in nice straight lines. So it, on the, your digitized image, if you just sort of add up the amount of ink on each row of the image, you get these peaks and troughs. So the peaks are, of course, where most of the ink is on the line, and the trough is the gap between the lines. With a bit of smoothing and jiggery pokery, you can allocate each of the lines of text to one of the detected lines. This doesn't show up here, does it? Can you not see? Not very well. This is the yeah, good thinking. You might just see that it's the same text. I've just coloured in, well, the machine has coloured each line a different colour, just to show that each line's been segmented. There are some problems. Sometimes people are very generous with their descenders and things, and they kind of cross the next line. That confuses the machine, and you'll have to believe me, I'm afraid. This block of yellow here covers three lines because there are descenders from the words above and below. Once I've got the lines, I'll use OpenCV as the vision library to do this work. I then chop up each line, every blob, if you like, or word shape, whether it's a word or a letter, is extracted from the lines and popped in its own file. File names are named after the page, the line, and the artifact. I don't know what else to call it. So when I'm looking at these, I know where it came from. And following that, I use OpenCV to generate the contour of the lines, the contour of the artifacts. So here's axes again. The contour that OpenCV generates is just an array of coordinates. So it might start here and go all the way round back to the start. So it's possible to use that, but I'm thinking of the future, and I've cut the contour in half. So there's the top half and the bottom half, and I've also collected the holes. That's the A and that's the E. I'm not doing anything with the holes at the moment. That's for next week. The top and the bottom, what I'm thinking is that if you leave it as a long array, the section of the contour, say here, is a very long way from, is it the other end of the array, from the end of the array here, this end of the contour, because it kind of goes around anti-clockwise. So you lose this sort of correspondence between this piece of, so I should use a pen or something just to get my finger out of the way. You lose the correspondence between this bit and this bit if you leave it in the wrong. So I've split them top and bottom, and it makes it easier to consider the beginning of each line as relating to the same bit of the word. So that was the generating the contours from the using OpenCV. But what we actually want to do is describe the shapes and compare the shapes. When you're playing with something like the name escapes me. What's Donna Kurt's system called that has all the vases and not research space before that. Claros, there we are. It has an image recognition system in it, so you can pop your image of a vase is, and it says, oh, this is our amphora or something, because it looks at the outline of the shape. When you're dealing with things like that, they have to invariant to rotation. So, you know, your pen might be that way, or you might see it that way, but they've got to match. And it might be here, it might be over there as well. So the translation and reflection doesn't really work with a pen because it's symmetrical, but a mug, might, the handle might be on the other side, and it's got to match that as well. And scale, of course. Is it, you know, the Father Ted, small, far away kind of thing? That's not so important for text because it has its own direction. We don't tend to write text in spirals or backwards unless you're Leonardo da Vinci. The only one that concerns us really is scale, because some people... The machine is supposed to work only on one person's handwriting at a time, but even so, you can vary your handwriting size. You're running out of space, you start to write a bit smaller or something. Again, that's something for the future. I'm just at the moment looking at a basic descriptor and comparison system at the moment. The last thing, of course, is we've already seen that we've got hundreds of years of work to do to manually transcribe all these documents, and the machine is supposed to help us do that much more quickly. So if we use some techniques that are computationally expensive, perhaps we're not going to improve things too much. So what we want is something that's quite cheap, something that's very quick to generate, something that's quick to compare. Now there are lots of ways of describing shapes, but because we're working with a contour, I'm just really going to look at the ways of describing that single line. The basic way of doing it, the easy way, of course, is a chain code, which basically allocates a direction. So given any point, the next point can be in one of eight directions on this sort of grid of your digitized image. So starting from any point here, for example, the next point is immediately to the right, which is in direction 2. The point after that is also in that direction, which is direction 2. Here we are. Diagonally down to the right is direction 3. You can see, if you don't know already about chain codes, you can build up a string like this, which, if you follow those instructions, you can regenerate the image. So it's a string of numbers that describes the shape. If you've got two shapes exactly the same, they should have exactly the same string. You can compare them, and bingo, the machine says, yay, yeah, they match. But there is a problem, of course, with digitized images. It tries to approximate curves. So if you imagine two curves that are almost the same but not quite. I'm sorry, I could have done with a picture here. So it might go one in that direction, two in that direction, one in that direction, two in that direction. And the other curve goes two in that direction, one in that direction, two in that direction, one in that direction. It's the same curve, but the numbers are going to be offset by one, and so they don't necessarily match. Another thing we looked at was the Pruitt compass filter. This is a sort of kernel that you convolve with your image, this kind of thing. And it's a bit like a polarizing filter, and it only lets through parts of the image that have a particular orientation. So this one has the orientation of 0 degrees, which I believe is this one. So given a full circle, it will only, or rather the outline of the circle, it's very interested in things in this direction. So the filter responds strongly where it's vertical and responds less and less as you deviate from the vertical. By rotating the kernel around one, the filter then becomes responsive to a different angle. So here we are, we've done it again, we've rotated it by one. I'm sure you can see from here the minus ones are there and the minus ones are here. It gives you another curve similar to the other one but rotated. They make very pleasing sort of astronomical type images, but you have to do this one 8 times, one for each of the position of the matrix. And of course you can see they overlap, it gives you nearly 180 degrees. So then you've got to try and work out where the business end, if you like, of each of these rotations is. It's an awful lot of work, basically, which is not what we were after. We want something that's quite quick. So rather than looking at the individual pixel directions or a response to a filter, what about the tangent? Because the tangent of the curve is the angle of that particular pixel. That again is something quite fiddly to calculate. So approximate it with a chord, which is a line that just joins 2 points of the curve. In this situation, of course, it's actually parallel to the tangent, and gives us the exact angle. As you move around, it's not quite right. I mean, this is an exaggerated version because it's quite a big chunk of the curve. So the blue line is our approximation. This is the actual tangent. In reality, I'm only using a 5-pixel window, which you slide around, so it's just difficult to do. Here we are, excuse my fingers. So we just slide a window around like that. The smaller window gives a better approximation than this large one. Of course, that gives us lots of angles in degrees, which is perhaps too... too much information, if you like. It's too fine-grained, so again, we're not going to match things easily. Back on the previous... these methods... This one gave us sort of 8 directions, so perhaps I can do something like that. So we quantize the angles into sort of 45 degree chunks. It gives us a reasonable amount of detail in that we know whether it's going up, down, left, right, and any of the 4 diagonals. Here we are. And this is the circle. I've just applied the method to it, run a chord around it, calculated the angles, quantized them into 45 degree chunks, and then coloured them in, and you probably can't see the colours anymore, can you? You can, they're all right, they're a bit, yeah, it's my angle. But you can see how it's allocated a direction. So straight up direction is grey, here we are, then white is this diagonal, if I apply that to word contours, then here you get this kind of thing. Sorry, it's just the way the words wiggle around. It's more like it's late on Friday night than. So on axes, I don't know if you can see, there are some similarities along the bottom. There's quite a lot of green because the green is this sort of horizontal direction. There's a great white bit here, 45 degrees. This one's got a big blue bit, that one's got a very tiny blue bit, purple bits. There's a nice light blue bit here. So you can see there are kind of similarities. Now that's the basis of the descriptor. These sequences of directions. They're quick to generate. It produces the string like the chain code, but the direction is not based on an individual pixel direction. It's a kind of average over the length of the tangent, really. But that kind of smooths out. And there's a different word there, with just so you can see that, you know, similar parts of the curves in similar directions are the same. And you can perhaps see that they wouldn't match because the sequences of coloured lines in directions in these two, which have some similarities, they're not really apparent in the word with. So I promised graphic motifs in the title. So this is as far as I've got with them. In the future, I'm expecting to. I'm going to see if I can extend this to cover larger elements. So, you know, the curve of a G descender, for example, or the upright of an L, and that kind of thing. But for the time being, I'm using a trigram representation. I've used trigrams before in text processing. If you're looking at a text, one thing you can do is your frequency analysis of the words. That just gives you the individual words. If you do a trigram or some other n-gram, then you get a bit more context because you've got the words around it. So I've borrowed that idea and applied it shape described outline. Our descriptor of the shape here. Just for example, here's the circle again, and taking sections of three at a time. Grey, white, light, blue, grey, white, light, blue, and then move around one and take three again, white, light, blue, purple, etc. So these are the trigrams that make up this. So currently these are the graphic motifs. So they're bits of curve, they're bits of sort of context, if you like, of curvature of the shape. In order to keep the number of parameters down at this early stage, I'm not looking at the length of each of these. All I'm interested in is the direction itself. So here's an example. It's not related to this, but the numerical representation of this kind of thing would be a string of numbers which indicate the directions, and the number of each digit indicates the length. So I can compress that to just the first, if you like, number of each direction, and then convert it to trigrams. It's wiggling again. And this is the representation that I'm using to describe the shapes. So I've done some frequency analysis of the trigrams that I've generated from a four-page John Evans letter, which is his Nash Mills letter, which he talks about his impending nuptials to his cousin. There's a section at the beginning about his nuptials, and then there's a bit in the middle where he's on a dig in France, and the crossing is very rough and tests his constitution. And then he gets there and he finds lots of axes and stuff, and then it's back to the nuptials. That one's very interesting because it's that actual trip. That's his Galapagos Island, if you like, moment where where all the bits come together, and he formulates the what we now know as paleontology. Why did I come? So because that was the document I looked at. So this is a frequency analysis of the trigrams. We've got eight directions, and they can occur three times. That's 512 possible motifs in our alphabet, but only 145 of them are used. Which in one way is surprising, but if you think about it, it's not, because when you're writing, you're writing the same letters over and over again, and they're all, you know, they've all got nice curves. The A's and O's have got nice curves. There's the tops of G's, A's, there's bits of curve in the descenders of the G, they're underneath, so, and some straightish bits on L's and I's. It's very difficult. You're not going to get many sort of arrowhead shapes. They don't really feature, you know, when we're writing. The motor movements make it quite smooth. So really, it's not that surprising that we don't use all of the alphabet. And in fact, well, this is the top 20 from here. So it's up to about there on the graph. You can see the trigram 567, which is this one, which is 567, is used 5,983 times, which is quite a lot. And I imagine that curve is the one that sort of comes between letters, as you can imagine this kind of shape in your writing. So here are the top one, top six. I've drawn them out. The thing to consider here, of course, is that if you're trying to find something, you don't want to be looking for common features in it. So if you're looking for a particular building in a street and you're looking around, you wouldn't use bricks as a feature to match, because they've all got bricks in. What you want are those features that are peculiar to the thing that you're looking at, that don't appear in other examples. So if you're going to, you looking at in here, there's this chunk here which appear in quite a lot of our word shapes or in these descriptors. They're not going to be hugely discriminating. perhaps we want to think more about these down here, where there are fewer of them, but they might be more particular to those words, because of the way the words formed. Maybe in the crossings of T's or X's or something like that, there's a feature that in there that doesn't necessarily appear in every word. And if there are a number of those features, then that's something that we could perhaps use as our matching tool. So observations for that. I think I've covered most of this. In the John Evans letter, there are 2,219 outlines. And that 567, the one at the top of the list, appears in 2,168 of those. So that one is kind of useless as a search feature, because you'll find it wherever you look. So high frequency motifs contribute towards numerous matches. So I've got the descriptor and these graphic motifs, but how can I use them to locate words of interest? This way of describing the document is very much like a sort of standard retrieval operation. So you've got a collection of documents, and then you've got a terms within those documents. And what you might do is the TF-IDF. Are you all familiar with that kind of thing? No, there's a no there. If you've got a collection of documents, so Google might do something like this. You've got a collection of documents, it's got words in it. So if a word that appears many times in a document, so if I've got a document, it says elephants in it lots of times, the document's probably about elephants, so that's quite important to that document. If the word appears in lots of documents, then it doesn't help to discriminate or to find that particular any particular document, because you'll find lots of them. So the TF-IDF score tries to take that into account, and the score goes up for documents. The score goes up for terms that are specific to a document, but then it goes down again for terms that are in lots of documents. So it tries to balance those two things. And then you would use the cosine similarity measure on those TF-IDF scores to try and work out whether documents are similar or not. So if you want elephants, you pop elephants in and it will find you all the documents that are similar to elephants. And I did try it on this data, but it wasn't entirely successful, and I haven't really found out why yet. I suspect that my data set is quite small, because it was only one letter that I was working on. And it may be that some of the motifs are very high frequency and the rest are very low, and there's not really much in between. And that may not lend, that type of data may not lend itself to this kind of measure. So I need to try it with a much larger data set. Perhaps there's not much variation in it, I think is what I'm saying. So instead I've used the bag of words model, which I think I hinted at earlier, which basically means that you just use the features as a collection. So, you know, if it's got something that's got whiskers and a tail and spots, you might say, well, that's a leopard. Because those features, you know, just a bag, they're, you're not ordering them anyway. It's got whiskers, it's tail, it's got stripes, it's a tiger. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm just popping the features in a bag. So I'm not really worried about the order of them. I'm just comparing one bag of features with another bag of features. We've said that the high frequency motifs are not going to help us at all. So for now, I'm going to just discard them. This is just a trial, just to evaluate the descriptors to see if they are of any, you know, if there's any merit in following them up. So this is a sort of typical result I might get from, or I do get from, the Nash Mills letter. And for this slide, I've used this shape as the query, and these correspond to three lines of I've just taken three lines of text. So three of them have got the word axe in, which this is, and one of them doesn't have axe in it at all. There's lots of manual work in producing this because I'm still working on the code, and you know, I'm doing stuff in Python, and then I produce some data, and I do a bit in Access because it's quicker than, you know, and I sort of stitch it all together manually to produce the results. I said it's early days. Anyway, there we are. There's the query shape. I give it three lines. Now the lines you remember I said I'm only looking at the top line at the moment when I split the contours in half. So all I've done is stitched all those top lines together to make one huge wiggly thing. Which is how I expect the application to work. You could stitch the whole document together if you like, but I'd probably do it line by line because you can then find the line easily that any matches appear in. So four lines it gets to search, and it returns things like this. This is the bag. I didn't write the bag on the slide for this query term, but it is these here. 645, 764, 065 and 706. That's all this has in its bag, because all the high frequency ones have been thrown away. So I get an exact match here. And I'll come back to that. So the red boxes are the matches. So yay, that's a good one. And it actually finds the word itself. That's the best match in there. And although I said it's a bag, these are actually the order that they appear in both dots. So it's kind of a bag that's sort of long and thin, so things go in the right order. Over here, again, I've got those four matches and in the same order, which is interesting. It's also this word's bag has also got 010. That's another low frequency motif that is not in the query. So again, hooray, that's another good one. Now this one is interesting. The things in its bag don't match at all. They're not these words. But you might notice that 534, if you add one to each of those, it becomes 645. Now, and likewise here. Now, I'm not sure if that's just wishful thinking at the moment. I've really got to do more evaluations. But by adding one, it's just basically a rotation in this scheme. So they are the same shape. but they're rotated. And early on I said that rotation doesn't really matter. But this is something to think about. Maybe they're on the cusp, those bits, and so that on the curve is just falls in one sort of 45 degree bucket on one word and is just in the next 45 degree word on the other. You know, maybe the paper was a bit askew and they, you know, right, it's a bit more slanted or italic. I don't know. I've really got to dig down and look at the data. But I mean, it's an interesting thing that maybe the search algorithm needs not to just perform exact matches, but have a bit of flexibility and identify similar shapes that are maybe in the next bucket one way or the other. Lastly, it matched this. Yeah, these are the actual things that it finds. And lastly, it finds this word in the sentence in the line that doesn't contain axes. It's only got one low frequency motif that matches in a whole load of other low frequency. Again, that might be telling that you know, as to the quality of the match. You know, a simple thing here would be they're all matches. That's 100%. What's we've got here? 80%, and that is, I haven't added them up, but you know, what should we say? 15% or something, 12% or something like that. So there's a basic scoring system there. I think I've come to the end, just about. I've just got some conclusions. I was pleased that the trigram representations are sort of easy to generate and to compare, which was one of the objectives of the work. This sort of prototype system where I'm just trying to evaluate the approach, as you saw on the previous slide, it's kind of interesting. There's something there to think about. And the next set of experiments will incorporate the lengths. Maybe that was a foolish thing to do, thinking that I reduce the number of parameters by removing the line lengths. Maybe they're actually necessary. That's I've thrown away the baby with bathwater in that. So that's something to look at. And lastly, the similarity metrics. You know, I've just done buckets, and I guessed at, just count up the number of matches and against the total number returned in a kind of I can't remember what it's called now. Precision recall type calculation. But there must be something more robust out there, a bit like the TF-IDF and that kind of thing, which I can use to sort of score the matches. So anyway, that's for next week. But yeah, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions,
perfect.
Right, thank you.